Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Jacob Shapiro Podcast. Joining me on the podcast today is Parag Khanna. He is the founder and CEO of Alpha Geo. He doesn't know I'm about to say some nice things about him, but I just want to say, you know, oftentimes you look up to people or to thinkers, and Parag is somebody that I've looked up to for literally all of my career. And sometimes when you meet those types of heroes or those types of people that you admire, you're disappointed. I've had that experience in my life too. I won't name names. But it was such a pleasure to talk to Parag, because it was that moment where actually when you meet the person, they're even smarter and better than you thought they were. So Parag, thanks for coming on the podcast and making the time. Parag and I connected because Alpha Geo helped put together a risk and resilience index for Henley & Partners. I was one of the people who tested it and wrote an essay reviewing it in an upcoming paper that's coming out from Henley. If you want a little bit of a taste of it, it's an index that tries to measure countries' exposure to geopolitical, economic, and climate risks and their capacity to adapt and recover. If you've been listening to the podcast for a long time, you know that resilience is a concept that I'm also very interested in too. I've always sort of flippantly described resilience as the capacity to imagine that the world could be different. But I think Parag actually does a better job of talking about it. If you're wondering what the top five most resilient countries are in the index, Switzerland, Denmark, Norway, Singapore, and Sweden round out the top five. Denmark, number two there, might be facing some geopolitical risk here very soon. I just put a post out on Substack about Greenland and the much longer historical relationship between the United States and Denmark than you might have assumed, and the history of land purchases between the two countries and what that might mean. It was a great conversation. Thank you, Parag, for coming on the show. I hope that you will come back on the show. Listeners, if you have any questions about anything on the podcast or want to talk to me, you can email me at jacob@jacobshapiro.com. Hope you are all keeping well. Take care of the people that you love. Cheers. See you out. All right, so Parag, we initially talked because you helped Henley put together this Global Investment Risk and Resilience Index, and I want to talk about that because I used it a bit and I wrote an essay reviewing it, but really I wanted to use that as an excuse to talk to you. And we were apologizing to each other before we hit record that, you know, I was sick and then you were sick and then it was holidays, everything else. But everything happens for a reason, because I get to have you on Thursday, January 8th. The U.S. just kidnapped Nicolas Maduro. Is Greenland next? Is Cuba next? Is Iran about to fall? I mean, the world is just, it's been a very geopolitically active couple of years, but it feels particularly fraught right now. So it's a wonderful time to have a conversation about resilience and risk and everything else. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. It's one of those weeks where decades happens, to paraphrase Lenin. So let's do it.
I love starting off by paraphrasing Lenin. It's a really, you know, a podcast is good when you're invoking Vladimir. Okay, well, before we get into the index itself, why don't we back into it? I would love to get your take on what's going on in the Western Hemisphere. Basically, everybody that I have talked to on the podcast in the last week or so, I've been trying to amplify voices from Latin America or from the United States trying to explain the policy perspective. You obviously are coming from a very different perspective. You've written a book about how, you know, the rise of Asia and Asian geopolitics is really the future of this century, will probably be defined by that. So from your perch, like, how are you thinking about what's going on in the Western Hemisphere?
I mean, I take a really long-term view of it because of my academic background in classical geopolitics. So the 19th century origins of the tradition as an academic field of study prescribe or contain a particular strand known as continentalism and pan-regionalism. And these are very important contexts or concepts. Continentalism refers to things like the Monroe Doctrine and the Louisiana Purchase and the acquisition of Alaska in the 19th century, which coincided with slightly or on the tail end of what was the Monroe Doctrine, which is pan-regionalism, which is a longitudinal approach looking at how do you not only secure your hemisphere from foreign intrusion, but it actually has a deeper climatological origin, which is that back then, without far-flung, just-in-time global food supply chains, empires wanted to have all growing seasons within their immediate, you know, vicinity under their control. And so there's strains, obviously, of Monroe doctrinism. We refer to it as if it's a purely, you know, risk board kind of thing, but it has a lot to do with climate and food security fundamentally. So continentalism and pan-hemispheric logic are 19th century geopolitical concepts that those of us that were, you know, nerds in the geopolitical sense, you know, decades ago were steeped in. So when I see what's happening in Cuba and in Venezuela or Greenland today, I brought back to that. And in my very first book 20 years ago, it was more than 20 years ago that I first set foot in Venezuela. And it's a place that I vowed, actually, I didn't ever want to return. And even 20 years later, when people ask me, you know, what's the worst place you've ever been? And in the intervening years, as you probably know, I deployed with U.S. Special Operations Forces. I spent a big chunk of time in Iraq and Afghanistan and been in Nigeria and, you know, Syria and all kinds of, you know, North Korea, everywhere. And I still say Venezuela is truly the worst place I have ever been. I put on Twitter recently a screenshot from a section of that first book about my, you know, sort of navigating the motorcycle gangs of Caracas. And I was like, I think I might die today. And it's the only place I've ever been where, you know, on any given day, I really thought I might just die. And I never made such preparations for my own demise in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in Nigeria amongst their gangs. I always felt like you could just, in Nigeria, you can talk or pay your way out of any situation. And I don't think you can necessarily do so in the lawless criminality, you know, that continues to beset a place like Venezuela. Anyway, linking the micro and the macro, one of the other things, you know, that comes to my mind is like back in the late 2000s when Greenland had its first referendum towards independence or additional home rule, self-governance. It happened to coincide with when I was doing my first TED Talk, and I created this visual animated image of Greenland, you know, emerging from due to climate change. So this, again, you know, recurrent theme with us, would vote itself independence as a result of the fact that it, you know, had this tremendous perch on Arctic maritime corridors, obviously was, you know, thawing and discovering rare earth minerals. So I figured it would eventually become the first country to be born of climate change, which is the phrase that I used in the talk. And that it would likely rationally become the fourth member of a North American federation, which is to say the United States, Mexico, Canada, plus Greenland. And of course, tectonically, Greenland belongs to the North American continental plate, not to the Eurasian plate. And its people, mm-hmm. the Inuit of Greenland, are ethnographically deeply linked, truly fraternal, identical to those of Canada. So it does make anthropological and almost, if geopolitics can be likened to poetry in any way, you know, sort of, you know, it comes full circle, and it does logically make sense that in some way, shape, or form, Greenland eventually become a North American state. And I think that it eventually will, sooner or later. It should not be an American colony by any stretch of the imagination. It should not be an American Puerto Rico. Right. But it should be an independent member of NATO, let's say, for example, with all of the benefits. I mean, and let's not go into too much detail on Cuba and Venezuela. There's a long checkered history, whether it is military or energy companies and so forth. But needless to say, you know, Venezuela is not going to be governed by the United States of America. Right. It's simply and what the U.S. is doing right now, as one of my friends has framed it, is, you know, trying to avoid the mistakes of Iraq and Afghanistan, to which my retort is, it doesn't mean that you're going to avoid other mistakes. You're just going to avoid one set of mistakes, which is the occupational hazards of having your military on the ground for 20 years in these countries. But there are other mistakes that are likely going to be made. But Venezuela has been rather ungovernable. I do think, you know, its resources are going to come to market. I mean, we can go on this. I've got a, you know, kind of long-winded, I've already have been long-winded, but a whole narrative around how the United States is going to wind up actually expanding the supply, obviously the output of Venezuelan oil, but primarily for Asian consumption at the end of the day. So it's going to be like the American Belt and Road infrastructure as a public good that serves global markets rather than China doing it. Now the U.S. is doing it, which is not necessarily bad either.
Yeah. Well, first of all, don't apologize for being long-winded. That's the whole point of having somebody on the podcast. I try to let people be long-winded. But it's also, so wait, I just have to pick on what you said. So you've also been to North Korea, and you thought Venezuela was worse than North Korea?
Well, the thing is about North Korea is that it has perfect stability for now. It does not have resilience, meaning if there is a crash, it's not a crash that the country is going to bounce back from, but it has stability. Mm-hmm. You've had regime continuity since the end of the Korean War. So it has an impeccable record of regime continuity, right? And therefore, quote unquote, stability. So there is an orderliness and a predictability to life there. At no point when you're in North Korea do you feel that your life is at risk, unless you're going to start to spray paint anti-regime propaganda on a random mural. You're obviously not going to, it's not going to end well, you know, for you. But if you go there as a quote unquote tourist, you're going to be perfectly well taken care of, which is not to say that you should therefore be susceptible to their propaganda. It's just that you're going to be fine. And this is a very common observation that travelers know about police states. Police states are quite, you know, almost by definition, the quote unquote safest places you can be. You know, no one will harm a hair on your head in a fair number of police states, precisely because either there are religious strictures or whether there is the retribution, you know, against the perpetrator, or because they don't want their reputation hurt, or because in effect everything is being monitored and they don't want any semblance of arbitrary violence, whether it's against a citizen or a non-citizen. So yes, you're perfectly safe in North Korea. That's like the most banal observation, quite frankly. It's utterly unimpeachable and irrefutable that it's a safe. So it's the arbitrariness of violence, and which is why it comes back to Latin America. For anyone who looks at these statistics, and I'm person 108,214 to write about this, but Latin America is by far the most arbitrarily violent region of the world, far worse than Africa, or quite frankly, you know, and more than the Middle East. Total casualties from violent from instances coded as civil war, domestic terrorism, or, you know, political violence, that may be higher in the Middle East. But arbitrary gang violence in terms of, you know, let's say handgun deaths per capita or something like that, are a zillion times worse in Latin America than they are in probably the worst, you know, tin pot Arab regime right now, probably worse than Yemen, for all I know. So people need to understand, you know, when we use terms like stability or violence or danger, you can categorize these things into certain archetypes of violence, and then you'll have a more formal measurement of why we're saying what we're saying. But I'm not just kind of, you know, shooting at the wind here.
I also wanted to ask you, so just to push on it further, and I mean, we cannot speak of Asia as a monolith. You can't even speak of China as a monolith. But if you were trying to talk about how Asian countries or regions of Asia are interpreting or interacting with the change in U.S. policy and posture, how would you put a neat bow on that? I mean, is there China and everyone else? Is there ASEAN and China and Central Asia and everything else? And how do you think they're interpreting it? Like, I've joked that, you know, there's probably some Chinese intelligence briefer that is telling Xi Jinping, this is exactly what Marx and Lenin predicted. Late stage capitalist country, like, eating itself alive. Keep on doing what you're doing. Like, everything is fine. And then there's everything else in between. How do you think? Yeah, I mean, it's an impossible question and it's an unfair question. But how is Asia interpreting what the U.S. is doing right now?
Right. So, right, for the purposes of this conversation, we probably don't want to go down the track of, like, Marxist theory and where in the evolution of the, you know, sort of teleology China itself falls versus where it sees us in this spirit of so-called late-stage capitalism and so on. So putting that aside, Asia is, you know, the most heterogeneous mega region of the world. You know, it has, whether it's cultural, civilizational diversity, or for our purposes, the geostrategic clusters, China, Japan, ASEAN, India, Central Asia, Australasia, even Russia, West Asian powers like Turkey and the Gulf countries, all of that is geographically Asia. Again, I'm using the term West Asia, which is very important. So remember, Turkey is geographically Asian. Saudi Arabia is geographically Asian. There is no such thing in geography as the Middle East. It's a strategic concept, a colonial concept, a historical artifact. It's not a geographical term. It's a geographical reference, but it's not a physical place, the so-called Middle East. So these places are Asia. So all of that is Asian. So how are they responding to, you know, Trump? Well, I mean, you know, what they're really, or the U.S., again, the story really goes back 36 years to the end of the Cold War, in which Asia began to more deeply, you know, or to accelerate its internal integration. whether it's the commodity super cycle, infrastructure networks, what we now call the Belt and Road Initiative, trade agreements, investment, migration flows, all of that is have deepened considerably consistently over the past three decades, such that Asia most has about 65% of its trade is internal. So the real story, to put it in a nutshell, is the is Asia insulating itself as much as possible from the volatility of the rest of the world. And that's not just a cute narrative. It's actually, if you go exactly to the Asian financial crisis of 28 years ago, is when Asian countries wanted to respond to whether it's onerous IMF conditionality or other kinds of demand shocks in the global financial crisis. Very, very, very formal episodes upon which, in every instance, Asian governments made very concrete regulatory decisions about reducing barriers to their own internal integration in order to diminish their dependence on the rest of the world. And so Trump just becomes the next chapter that validates that approach that, that's been consistent for 30 years. And it's Asians have done well with that strategy. And so they're finding ways. So you're seeing that even rivals, hostile countries, such as China and Japan and South Korea, and even China and India, for example, are now finding ways to deepen their partnerships in order to insulate themselves from the Trump shocks, which is, again, just the latest shock emanating from geographies west of themselves, whether it's Brexit, Trump 1, Trump 2, COVID, the GFC, you know, you name it. They've been, from their point of view, this is just another episode in a 30-year history of why Asia needs to further integrate and why it will continue to further integrate. And the Ukraine war is a great gift to them, because it's basically, you know, dropped Russia, the world's largest country and one of the largest food and energy producers on earth, literally dropped Russia into their lap, where you can get energy at bargain basement prices. And Russia now wants to deal more and tilt towards Asia, to copy, to borrow Obama's phrase. It's actually not the US that tilted towards Asia. It's Russia that tilted towards Asia.
What is your view on the role that China plays here? Is China the hegemon? Is China the economic center of gravity? Is it first among equals? Like, how do you think about China's role in this emerging geography?
Well, so that's in the hierarchy is in the eye of the beholder, right? And so, you know, for China's point of view, it's a reconstitution of the ancient tributary system that persisted across multiple dynastic periods during the time that we would refer to as the Middle Ages. But, you know, others don't see it that way, because obviously the big shift is sovereignty. Now, for China, sovereignty is just some kind of a legal fiction or construct that they don't necessarily have to respect other than on paper. And they certainly don't. They view the world through the lens of supply chains. And this was like, you know, a big theme in one of my books was like, you know, the sort of persistence of empire and, you know, supply chains matter more than borders and so on and so on. So in any case, But the rest of the world doesn't see it that way, right? If you're Thailand or if you're Indonesia, sovereignty matters to you because you've been a colony. You were a colony for, you know, hundreds of years. So what I see is that these countries don't have the power to balance against China, and certainly don't want to fully bandwagon with it. So they're somewhere in between. And so they practice what I call multi-alignment. And multi-alignment is that fine diplomatic art of cooperating with China when you need to, but pulling in the United States or other powers, or having sub-regional associations to try and offset Chinese pressure. So cooperation amongst the so-called Quad countries in the South China Sea, for example, to resist Chinese encroachment on their maritime, you know, possessions, while at the same time signing the largest trade agreement in world history with China, known as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So the both-and approach, the multi-alignment approach, is how I would characterize it. And so, you know, hierarchy, again, is it may be satisfying to create a static mental image or diagram in your mind of who's on top. And we suffer from the same tendency at the global level to always want to ask and answer the question, who's number one? Is it America? Is it China? The question, you know, these days, more sophisticated international relations or geopolitical scholarship focuses on context, on relationality as the key filters through which you answer that question, rather than simply creating a hierarchy and saying that this is a rigid, permanent condition, because there is no permanence anymore.
Yeah. I find that the West, yes, like there's this never-ending pointless conversation about who is number one. I also find that the West, and particularly the United States, it's very hard to get around what you just talked about, because it's, you're either with us or you're against us. You're either access of evil or you're in the arsenal of freedom, and there's sort of nothing in between. Yeah. What you're talking about is actually a very uniquely, like, actually you can be both at the same time and we can still trade with each other and like each other's food and like behave with each other just fine. That's something that the United States is not very good at and seems to be getting worse at. I mean, why else would they be talking about conquering Greenland when they already have everything they need from Greenland? Okay, I'm going to start veering us towards the Henley conversation via something I've been wanting to ask you for a while. Because, you know, globalization was primarily a state-driven phenomenon. And I think one of the interesting things that has come out of the Trump administration is that they're doubling down on the nation state to a certain extent, if you believe the, you know, policy papers that are coming out of there. But, you know, some of the work that you've done that's always interested me the most is your work on connectivity and network power and about how these are defining aspects of the 21st century. And I find that the more multipolar the world gets, the more that seems to be right to me, and the more I get interested in the rise of city-states again, or the rise of Bitcoin versus normal currencies, or the rise of, you know, technologically driven companies that become stronger than the state in general. And so what I wanted to throw at you, because the Global Investment Risk and Resilience Index that you're talking about is also about national vulnerabilities. You're measuring things at the national level, and yet there is this narrative that the 21st century is going to be about connectivity and network power outside of the control of the nation state. So that's a big question. I wanted to start with the connectivity network power thing and how that intersects with the state, and then get into how you built an index for the 21st century, but having to focus at a state level in order to make it intelligible to people who are using it.
Sure. I mean, to make things intelligible for people in an index, you almost always do default to the national level, even though most nations are apples and oranges, even to each other. But for most people, it's apples to apples. Whereas in reality, the degree of stateness of the state varies so considerably that it really is a spectrum. But for conventional purposes, for, you know, standardization, for a product like an index that's actually used in markets or by investors, you generally just default to the state. You know, as a political scientist, again, I have all sorts of problems with that, but for the purposes of something like this. Now, the second, you know, sort of analytical point is also not as contradictory as it may seem, because in a way, the scores attributed to a state or the values attributed to a state subsume the performance of its cities, right? So if a country ranks very high in international financial market connectivity, it's obviously because the capital city stock exchange is a, you know, high liquidity financial instrument, you know, or vehicle, right? So again, the state subsumes the city for the purposes of a product like this. Within a given country, are there vast amounts of spatial inequality and you know, and so forth? Of course there are, but we already know that. And that's something that we get into in other products, you know, that we do. And there's lots of products, obviously, for cities. But, you know, I think what's most important about the Henley Index is that rather than look only at risks, we're actually just trying to measure resilience. I mean, the real background to the whole initiative is that it's one chapter in a whole sort of arc or body of research that we at AlphaGeo have been driving on quantifying resilience. Resilience for so many people is a anthropological, sociological, you know, it's almost a psychological attribute, right? You know, how can you bounce back from shocks, from injuries, from social dislocation and pressures, but how do you measure the resilience of a geography is not a well-scrutinized, investigated question. That's something that we at AlphaGeo have already built an entire product for. We built a whole company around answering this one simple or single but extremely difficult question, which is tell me mathematically the resilience of a place, any coordinate on Earth at any scale. We happen to do it at the level of an address. So literally your home in New Orleans versus the one that's 10 kilometers north, we will have different resilience scores for two locations. But how do you do it at a country level? So we said, let's take our general framework around risk, adaptation, and resilience and apply it at national scale. What metrics would we use? And so, of course, the methodology is very transparently documented. the risk factors are actually quite conventional. It's everything from, you know, balance of payments or, you know, inequality or currency strength, inflation, unemployment, political risk, and then the resilience attributes. So institutional capacity, net inward FDI flows, and, you know, a wide range of other indicators, quality of infrastructure. So we're using risks and resilience factors, offsetting them and coming up with our aggregate scores. And then, of course, you have a scoring mechanism because the public, you know, likes that. But when I roadshow this to governments, we don't really focus too much on the headline scores, right? I mean, it's what opens the door. But what the smart governments, what I like to call kind of technocratically oriented, progressive governments, where I'm talking to the civil service and the cabinet level, what they want to know is, where was I deficient? What can I do better? Tell me how to improve. You know, are these indicators that comport with my national values? Are these things that are in our roadmap anyway? What can we learn from other countries through this benchmarking exercise? That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where you roll up your sleeves. That's when, and I'll name names, you know, when I'm working with the governments of Kazakhstan or the United Arab Emirates or Singapore or Saudi Arabia, you know, around the world, many progressive or at least well-intentioned regimes take this data at face value. They kick the tires. They like the methodology. They look at specific areas where they've not scored as well as they would have liked, and they want to learn. And to me, the best conversations are either with people or with governments, right, that want to learn, that want to self-improve. And so, you know, in the original framing of this, I one sentence I wrote was simply, you know, how does a state become a better version of itself? Well, what every person wants and what every society wants is to be a better version of itself. And it's not to become like America. It's not to become like Japan or China or England, right? It's how do we become tomorrow a better version of ourselves according to our own vision of ourselves. And that gels very, very strongly with my own personal view and ideology.
Yet doesn't necessarily gel with classical geopolitics, which in some sense is the study of the things that cannot change. It doesn't matter if you have good intentions, like it's the study of the things that will constrain you from being better, which I love that dissonance. I live in that dissonant area too. This may be a strange question, but so when you're talking with different actors like that, like what are the variables that are easiest for them to try and fix? And what are the variables that would be like impossible for them to try and fix? Is that question?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it really does depend though on the circumstances of the country, right? And that gets back to your point about the certain immutable factors in geopolitics, such as your geography, right? You can't change that so much. So, or your resource endowments or your current population size. But a country can import more talent. A country can change certain investment regulations. A country can invest in R&D and innovation. It can build more fiber optic internet cables. It can improve the status of women in its society, and it can raise wages, right? So there are lots of things that lots of countries can improve on that drop of a hat if they are so inclined to do so. And what I have found promising and heartening over the last 25 years that I've been, you know, more professionally traveling around rather than just backpacking, although I still backpack around, is the number of governments that I have interfaced with and directly work with and supported, who are taking that approach to it, that fine scalpel approach, saying, look, don't come in with some grand vision of reinvention. Right. You know, sort of the whole Afghanistan is going to be like Switzerland mentality. Right. Help me with what I can do tomorrow. Right. And that's why we try to be so detailed in the methodology and in the documentation of the metrics and features, so that countries can pick and choose. What can I do today? Maybe there are some things that, you know what, this is going to take some time. We deal with governments that say, ooh, well, to implement this, I'm going to really need a huge aid package from the World Bank, you know, or some regional development bank. But the fact that they're saying, what are the sequences? What are the cost benefit analysis? How do I get this done? That's what I like to see, is that good faith effort.
Yeah. You mentioned the thought experiment of thinking about this in New Orleans. And I want to like bring this down to earth a little bit for listeners, which is, I mean, like I didn't have access to AlphaGeo's New Orleans product, right? but I had these calculations. Like I told my wife when we moved here, we're going to be as close to the river as we possibly can be because that's the high ground. And we picked a neighborhood and a house that never flooded in a quiet part of town that historically was like kind of away from the port action and everything else, but close enough that it could be to a center of economic activity. You are talking about mathematically describing like what those things look like on a city level or on a state level. So these are actually decisions that all of us are making every single day.
Yeah,
and that you're trying to quantify. I'm sure you thought about this. So let me ask it. I mean, because you know, classical geopolitics does think about these things that are immutable, but nothing is immutable. And technology can change geography. You know, it can't necessarily change geography, although it can also do that. But it can also change a geographic challenge overnight. Practically, how did you integrate that kind of technological change into an approach like this? I mean, I'm sure the thing that would be ringing in people's ears right now is, okay, is artificial intelligence might change everything, or robotics might change everything. How do you make it, how are you flexible enough to integrate sort of that kind of completely changing technological advance? Is that even possible? Like,
Well, so, you know, because this index is a composite of other scores and indices, right? We haven't, other than the climate adaptation scoring, which is proprietary to AlphaGeo, you know, and a couple of other things, we've used third-party existing reputable indices. So one of them is something like AI readiness. So AI readiness scores for a given country are a composite of things like the digital penetration, the internet speed, the R&D budget, you know, a capital formation in venture capital. Are there tech companies and AI companies in the country, and so on? The IMF does it. Stanford does it. You know, lots of different people do it. So there is a credible score for AI readiness. That's the micro level answer. And again, a country can then, if you rank low in that metric, you're going to dig into the details and say, oh, you know, what can I do better? Who can I learn from? Who are the countries proximate to me, whom I can interact with more, trade with more to enhance my own economic complexity? The economic complexity index is one of my favorite sources, you know, to capture the innovation potential or the change in innovation capacity of a country over time by measuring the intensity of trade that it has with higher value added countries in its trade network. So ECI, Economic Complexity Index, AI Readiness, these are things that we are basically repackaging and integrating and scoring in this broader risk and resilience framework. So are you going to be adaptable to technological change is something that you can measure by way of these proxies. The deeper question, which I think is really important, is that you're alluding to, is that technology is not some separate category of thought, you know, from geopolitics. All geopolitical theory accounts for in some measurable way the technological foundations and comparative technological capabilities of a state. It used to be measured by things like simply how many commercial vessels do you have in your merchant marine, or obviously how many warships do you have, or what is obviously your industrial potential and output as measured by steel mills and cotton gins, and so on and so forth. So all of that now has evolved to look at the broader thematic of this is what's known as leading sector theory. And leading sector theories is an entire school of geopolitics that looks specifically at the key technologies of any given era, whether it is nuclear weapons or whether it's AI, and it tries to measure and stack up. It could be biotech, robotics, renewable energy, and so forth, nanomaterials, and so on. To measure and compare states according to their technological capacity. So deeply embedded in geopolitics is everything that we think of as technology and even finance for that matter. So geopolitics is almost a misnomer. Geopolitics in its core methodologies has always been a truly holistic approach to attributing power to places.
You alluded to it briefly, but let me ask it explicitly, like both in the index, but also just in your own work. How do you see Africa in particular playing a role or not playing a role? Because it should rank relatively low by just about any metric, whether we're talking about technological penetration or resilience of states and regimes. It feels like we're headed towards a great game for Africa rather than, you know, this glittering, oh, this is where demographics are increasing and population is increasing, sort of, et cetera. How do you conceptualize Africa in this world that we're going into?
I'm pretty bearish on Africa, and I probably, you might say, always have been. And, you know, I've given allowance to write about Africa in all of my books in some way, wherever it's relevant. So I'll give you kind of the composite synthesis of it all, which is to say, well, first of all, you know, geographically, it belongs to a geo-economically belongs to a fairly marginal sphere, right? I mean, it's a rounding error in the world economy. It has raw materials and resources that it exports, and some countries benefit from those resource exports, but you don't have a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. So the most important thing to say about Africa is that it's a tectonic, a geological formation, but it is not a whole greater than the sum of its parts. There is no African, meaningful African Union that is supranational, that's an equivalent to the European Union that makes Europe a whole greater than the sum of its parts. Even North America is a whole greater than the sum of its parts, you know, which is something I always have to remind people in the US. Africa is no such thing. Africa is, you know, mostly disconnected sub-regions, right? West Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, Central Africa, Horn of Africa, East Africa, North Africa, and so on. So you can have specific conversations about specific sub-regions of Africa and come to completely different conclusions about their future. And therefore, your answer to the question, the future of Africa, is going to vary depending on how you score those sub-regions. Then demographics, I mean, demographics are both a blessing and a curse. You know, and the demographic forecasts about Africa as a whole tend to hinge on your projections for Nigeria, which are wildly inflated given the fact that African fertility in general and Nigerian in particular are coming down as a result of a struggling economy, resource constraints, urbanization, a wide range of factors. The final nail in the coffin, I don't want to really call it a coffin, but I mean, there's several though, unfortunately. One is obviously climate change, which will have a devastating impact and is having a devastating impact in terms of droughts in particular across Africa. And then there's just technology to come, you know, back to your previous point, because in conventional, you know, macroeconomic or international trade theory, or globalization theory, you just imagine that capital chases the lowest cost of labor. And therefore, after China, Southeast Asia, and India, global supply chains will inevitably migrate to Africa, and therefore it will become the next factory floor of the world. But absolutely no such thing is ever going to happen. And the reason is because of robotics and automation. So Africa is being cut out because of robotics and automation. Everyone would rather invest in a robotic factory in their own country and maybe power it through certain African minerals or fuels, but not actually build it in Africa. Why would you do that, right? When you can just open up African ports and export to Africa. So industrial policy and technology will get in the way, or are getting in the way. And this is not something that Africa can change, and it will not change. We have to be able to look in the 5-10 year horizon and make certain confident forecasts. And there's not one shred of evidence that anything Africa is doing could turn around what I'm describing right now. So bottom line is Africa needs to fix Africa for the sake of Africa, and it needs to do so through greater internal integration, free labor mobility, a single market, domestic investment in infrastructure, light manufacturing, agriculture, climate adaptation, digitization, education, 1,000 things. I mean, you know, on paper, we could fix Africa tomorrow. But as we know, it's going to take a really long time to get there if it ever happens at all.
Yeah. Well, on paper, we could solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict tomorrow too. But as
that's why I make maps.
Okay, I could talk to you for hours, but I know I got to get you out of here on this. So I do not pose this question to everybody that comes on the podcast, but I think you're up to the task. And listeners will know that this is something that Vance Crow brought on my podcast originally. What is one thing, one deeply held view that you have that everyone in your tribe, so in your tribe of classical geopolitics, et cetera, does not believe? Like, what is one thing that you're really out there on that nobody else who's in your milieu really like actually holds to?
I mean, I published on this, so I'll just state it as exactly the same sentence. Devolution matters more than democracy. The path to peace, let me reframe it. Please. Devolution is a more important contributor to peace than democracy. So the conventional wisdom is democratic peace theory. Once, if states are democracies, they don't fight wars with each other, and so on. But the historical record shows that the reason we have peace in the world, we have peace because we have devolution, because we have fragmentation, because we actually have either peacefully or violently the creation of new states. So a more peaceful world is a world in which you've created the maximum number of independent, sovereign political units that feel that they now self-govern their own territory. Whereas people want to promote democracy as a pathway to peace, my view is that we should be promoting new state formation, even if it requires a certain degree of violence. So that is my deeply held view. It's also historically extremely well-grounded, which is some why I've already published on this topic. But yes, devolution matters more than democracy, to put a bump, to make it a bumper sticker.
I'm not surprised that you had a good answer for that. Parag, thank you so much for taking the time. And I hope that we'll line it up and we'll talk longer next time. Thanks so much.
Such a pleasure. Anytime.